Hello, listeners, and welcome to this third episode of the Northwest Young Fabians podcast. Today, we're speaking to two members of our exec, Amy Dwyer and Helen Clark. Amy is the Women's Officer for the Northwest Young Fabians, and Helen is the Vice Chair and Secretary. We're going to be talking about women's issues in politics, Kamala Harris's nomination as the Vice President, and a little quiz at the end. And Tom has got a new feature with his Trump fact check. So on to the show.
Amy, I first of all wanted to ask about your role and what you want to do with it. So you're obviously our women's officer. And I'm aware that female representation isn't very good inside the Northwest Young Fabians right now. Is that something you want to lead on as our women's officer?
Yeah, definitely. In one of the first meetings, they said that the female members, I think, make up around 12%. I think there's literally just 17 women in the Northwest, which is really, really disappointing. So that's definitely what I'm focusing on this time. I'm trying to get in touch with the women's officers from CLPs around the region and just try and engage women a bit more, because I think women in general don't engage in politics, and if they have an outlet like the Young Fabians, a way of doing so that's like safe and friendly, then they'll be much more likely to maybe go into politics in the future.
Excellent. And Helen, you're obviously the only other female member of our executive. And what do you want to do with your role? What are the things you want to lead on?
I mean, obviously getting more female engagement is really important to me, but my kind of primary focus at the minute is on the political education, and I think the two go hand in hand. So I think a lot of what stops any young person getting involved in politics is how kind of complicated it can be, how much jargon there is, all kind of unnecessary processes that exist. So I really want to kind of dissect that for people and make it a lot more accessible. And I think as an exec team, that would be a really great thing if we could achieve that demystifying of politics.
Great. This is a question for both of you. Why do we need all women's shortlists and why do they matter?
I understand why some people don't like all women's shortlists. But I think, you know, there was a lot of successful female MPs that have been elected through all women's shortlists. So I think, you know, the main argument against them is that, you know, we want the best person for the seat, no matter whether a male or female. But the people that have been elected through all women's shortlists are really successful and did a lot for their constituents. So I think there's not really any reason why not to. We should be doing everything we can to achieve gender parity. And this is a successful and effective way of doing that.
Yeah, right. I'd echo that sentiment completely on the kind of gender parity. I mean, that's why they were introduced. So I've been on a number of training sessions with the Labour Women's Network, and obviously it's their initiative that they're really passionate about, because they want to get to a place where we have 50% representation in the House of Commons, and the Labour Party are really strong on that at the minute with the kind of most female MPs that they've had. And we just want to encourage every other party to get behind that and to reach that 50-50% in Whitehall. And yeah, I think all women shortlist has proven year on year that it's increasing that percentage, and that's what I'd say to anyone who kind of doesn't see the point in it, because mm-hmm. that's its objective and it's achieving that.
How do we work towards getting closer to 50-50 inside the Northwest Young Fabians? Because to be honest, as you said, the current numbers, even 60-40 would be a massive improvement on what it currently is, because it's awful. So how do we think we get closer to that 50-50?
For me, I think a lot of it's around the language. I think a lot of young women in the Northwest, is the same as in every other region, maybe don't see themselves as politically active or as politicians, or as, you know, overly involved in that kind of side of it. Whereas there are so many great young women and women of, you know, all kind of ages in every region, especially in the Northwest, who do so much community activity. Like, they're running church groups, they're running youth clubs, you know, they're running food banks, they're running charities, they're running CICs, and they think, oh, that's not politics, that's community. But to me, it's the same. If you have those leadership skills and you have that passion to do better in your community, you can organise people and you can organise activities and events and fundraise and bring people together for a common cause, that's politics. You're already doing it. So why wouldn't you want to take that next step, which isn't a huge leap, and I understand it could feel like that to some people, but just the next step to say, actually, everything I'm doing is kind of underpinned by the laws of the country. Why wouldn't I want to be represented in that lawmaking process and get more involved in policy?
As two women within the Labour Party, what's your experience been like so far since you joined?
So I've only joined the Labour Party. I joined it late last year, but I've only really sort of become active in it. And I found it quite daunting at first, not just the jargon as well, but I think because I've always seen politics as quite a male-dominated field. So I think in some ways it has been daunting, but I think the Young Fabians is a really great way to engage more in policy and help demystify the Labour Party a little bit, but without, you know, there's no pressure and everyone kind of respects what each other thinks, so there's no like infighting. It is just quite an easy way to really engage, and I think that would really help quite a lot of young women. They're just not aware of it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I've been a member of the Labour Party for over a year now, and I've been lucky enough to not have experienced any kind of sexism, but I know it's been there in my kind of region before I joined, because you know, you hear things from people. But generally, everyone's been so kind of supportive. So we have a women's forum in Bury North, and kind of from the first meeting, it was like, what do you want out of this? Like, how can we help you? And it was so open, which was great, rather than this is where we think you'd fit, or we think you should be a youth officer or a women's officer. It was, what do you want from the party and how can we help you achieve that? And I think the approach is the same in the Fabians, and that's, I think, a really great way to get good results from anyone.
Excellent. And then Helen, we know that we talked a bit previously about working on events to do with policy and the policy that impacts upon women in the Northwest and the UK. Do you maybe want to talk a bit about this idea, this event, and any ideas like that you've got going forward?
Yeah, I think it's really tempting to put on an event for women around policy and think, oh, we're talking about kind of contraception, or we're talking about parental leave, or we're talking about maternity leave, and make it specific issues that might not affect all women. And I think it would be great to just say, around policymaking, there are so many more men in the profession, in the arena, and in the societies than there are women. Why is that? Why isn't your voice being heard? Because it's actually dead easy to get involved. It's actually dead easy to be heard. And I think a lot of really successful women's events I've seen, so like from Fabian Women's, from the Labour Women's Network, or things like the Fawcett Society, kind of play on that idea that women are told, or women are kind of shown, that they couldn't be working in this area of politics or policy making. Don't you think that's wrong? And generally the kind of feedback you get is, yeah, I do actually, so how can I get involved? So I think it would be a really interesting event to kind of raise the awareness of the gender imbalance in policy making, and just show how easy it is for people to get involved and how there's no wrong answer. If you have an opinion on any political topic, which every person does, every woman does, then get involved, and it doesn't have to be around contraception, it doesn't have to be around specific women's issues. If you want to talk about finance, you want to talk about the economy, you want to talk about the climate, you can. No one's stopping you but yourself. So get on board, and we can make it as easy as possible.
That's so important. I think that because women are almost sort of neglected in policy discussions, when they do get involved, when they are consulted, it is strictly around women's issues. And you know, women don't just have opinions on contraception or abortion. We have opinions on finance, on transport, on education. So it's important that it's not just in issues that affect women that women are involved. It should be every area, because we're half the population, so we deserve a fair say.
So obviously we haven't had a permanent leader of the Labour Party who's been female yet. How do we work towards this, and why has it not happened?
I think it's not happened, honestly, because people think it's a big deal, which might sound really controversial, but I don't mean it to be. As we kind of just said, yes, it should be the person that's best for the job. It shouldn't be a big deal. It should be kind of, we have a female leader, yeah, and the same that it should be, you know, someone's gay, yeah, and. Like, it's not a whole identity. Yeah. They have experience, they have knowledge. And I think people think, well, if I tick that box for Angela Rayner or for Lisa Nandy, I've made a change. No, you haven't. It's the same party. And it's one person at the end of the day. There's a whole team of people around Keir Starmer at the minute making decisions. It's not just him. You know, everyone in your CLP, everyone in your regional party, everyone across the country, oh, they generally all stay the same. So all your staff members, all your membership, you know, all your kind of councillors and all your MPs, like, we're not changing the party drastically to elect a woman. It shouldn't be a big deal. And I think that kind of imaginary barrier is what stops people voting that way or encouraging women to stand or listen to women's voices or amplifying them, because they think, oh, this would be a change. And I don't think it would be. And I don't think having a female leader or a male leader of the Labour Party quietens down the voices of any women in the Labour Party. I don't think I've met many shy women in the Labour Party. We all get heard, and we all make damn sure we are heard, and we will be heard, whether we have a female leader or a male leader. So for me, I think that's what stops it. People thinking, oh, it's a major paradigm shift. I don't think it is. I don't think it should be.
It almost seems as if men vote, well, obviously not all men, but if like some men vote for a female leader like Lisa Nandy, then they'll think that, you know, radical feminism will take over the Labour Party and all the men will be got rid of. Like, no. It is disappointing because it's the only major party now that hasn't had a female leader. You know, Lib Dems, Conservatives, SNP, they've all had one. And we should have had one by now. So it is disappointing that we haven't. So it will be really great to see a female leader next time, hopefully.
So we're going to move on now. We're going to be talking about Kamala Harris, who is Senator for California and has been nominated by the Democrats to be the Vice President and chosen by Joe Biden. She's a Black woman, and she's the first Black woman to be on a presidential ticket in the US. So I'm going to ask, what do you think of her, and was she the right person for the job?
Politically, she was a very sensible pick, and she was probably the most obvious pick because, unfortunately, Biden said that he wanted a female running mate, and then after Black Lives Matter, it became quite evident that he wanted a female of colour for a running mate. And once you get to that situation, there's a very limited pool of people he could have chosen from, because really you need someone of some level of experience of federal politics. So Kamala's only the second ever woman to be on, to be nominated by a major party to be vice president. The previous one was Sarah Palin by John McCain back in 2008. Sarah Palin dragged McCain's ticket because really her experience of federal politics was non-existent, having been the governor of Alaska and a not so great governor of Alaska at that. So really he needed someone experienced in federal politics, and that pretty much left with Kamala Harris, who, as Owen said in that intro, is the Senator for California, and has been quite a rapid rising star within federal politics for the Democrats. But I'd be fascinated to hear off our two guests what their thoughts are on Kamala Harris.
Yeah, right. I think it's a really sensible pick, and I think a lot of these discussions are happening at the minute around her, and all this stuff on Twitter, and a lot of it is focused around she's the first kind of female woman of colour, and isn't that amazing? And for me, when people say things like that, I always think yes and no. Like, yes, it's great, it's happening, but no, shouldn't this have happened sooner? And I think you made a really good point there, that it's a limited pool to pick from if you want to pick a woman of colour to kind of put on your ticket. And isn't that the problem, I suppose? So just taking that out of it for a second, like, for if it was another white man on that ticket, then yes, it makes complete sense. She's had an amazing career. I mean, she's been kind of district attorney, she's been attorney general, she's been a senator, she's an author, she's done so much in her own right. And she does have that experience, like you say, of the kind of American political sphere. So I think when we talk about her, it's really important to focus on, like you say, that career, that experience and that knowledge, and kind of go, And it's also great that this is the first time we've done that, but it won't be the last, and it shouldn't be the last. And let's say she makes it, and I hope that she does, that should not be the last, and that pool should just continue to grow. And I really hope whatever happens in that election, be it good or bad, that it makes women everywhere, and especially women of colour everywhere, think, oh yeah, I could do that, whether they're, you know, 40 odd, whether they're in their 20s, whether they're 9 years old, and think, oh, actually, yeah, why couldn't I do that? And yeah, why couldn't you? Why couldn't you do it now? Why couldn't you do it in your country, wherever your country is, whatever your region is? Do you know what I mean? I think it's a lot of, maybe a lot of pressure to put on her to be the first, but if she gets there, amazing, let's get more. If she doesn't get there, okay, let's get more. I think that should be the attitude.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think especially it's interesting whenever it's like the first female vice president or candidate for presidency, it's almost as if she's responsible for so much more than just her own platform. Like, for example, Hillary Clinton, you know, was responsible for her husband's actions when Donald Trump wasn't even responsible for his own. So I think women are held, they're scrutinised a lot more. So I think it's really great that she is the first woman of colour. But I think it's important that we don't put sort of too much pressure on her to sort of represent all women of colour that have like ever existed, if you know what I mean. Like, she's allowed to make mistakes just like anyone would. You know, if a man made mistakes, he's not going to get as much hate as she would in the same situation. So I think it's really, really great, and it is a step in the right direction. But again, I think we've only really reached equality when this isn't a news story anymore. Like, it's obviously it's really great and we should celebrate it, but we've only reached complete gender equality and gender parity in government when these aren't major headlines that we have a woman as a vice presidential candidate. So I think, yeah, it is moving in the right direction, but it has quite a long way to go still.
Yeah, no, and the research is really quite interesting on the way voters perceive female candidates for office, and that is true. The only females they tend to actually like tend to be females they regard as displaying masculine traits. They tend to not like women who display feminine traits, say, for office. And then the same thing, they will hold them accountable for the actions of the men that are in their lives. So as you said, Hillary Clinton was completely held accountable for the actions of Bill Clinton. I mean, Hillary is an interesting pick because Hillary was very much a Marmite politician. You either love Hillary or goddamn you hate her. And that's a real problem when you're running for president of the United States. Kamala doesn't have that, but already we're seeing some really sexist takes out of Trump fans on Biden's running mate, and that's troubling. And yeah, as you both said, there is so much a long way to go, but we're getting there. You know, we are getting there. Just next to have a female leader of the Labour Party. Hey,
yeah, we've obviously spoke a bit about what are the implications of having Harris picked as the vice president. Do you think?
The implications are, I think I'm going to focus on the electoral implications, but generally electoral implications are, she doesn't add anything in terms of her home state, her home, you know, being the Senator for California. But then again, there's not really much evidence that the state your running mate comes from makes much difference to the performance you do in that state. You do like 0.3% better, I think it is, on average. It's California. Biden's going to win California. If he doesn't win California, he certainly isn't going to be president. On the more implications for running the electoral politics of it, though, is that Kamala has sort of this appeal with most of mainstream Democratic opinion. She's fine. She's liked by mainstream Democratic opinion. There's elements of the liberal left that like her. Some liberals like her, but also it's important to remember that a lot of liberals didn't vote for when she was running for the presidency. And that in reality, most liberals, even young liberals of colour, were voting for Bernie to be president, so not Kamala. But she has a level of appeal. I think the more important electoral point about her is that she doesn't harm Biden's key coalition at the moment, which is old white folk, and they don't have a problem with her. And that's rather important when one of the key route maps is to win back old whiter voters who live in places like Wisconsin, Michigan. And to be honest, the route map that Biden takes towards winning that, although not completely applicable, we really need to learn some lessons from over here, because we're facing similar problems with a coalition of older white voters who cluster in areas that used to be safe for our party. And in the same way for Democrats, with Michigan in particular, it would be unthinkable that Trump would have won that. But there you go. It was Clinton's firewall. It was what the blue wall that gave Clinton the presidency back in the 90s. So she doesn't harm that demographic, and that's also important. The idea that women of color doesn't automatically mean, oh, white voters won't vote for you. There's more to it than that. But I'll hand over to Amy and Helen on perhaps the implications for women.
I think maybe in like a more abstract sense, it's just the fact that it's given women, but specifically women of colour, who've historically had a real lack of people to aspire to in politics. It's given these young women, you know, someone to look up to, someone to see in that position of power and think, you know, I can do it. There's nothing inherently blocking me from doing that. So I'm going to try and do that. And we need more people in those positions of power to push women, but specifically women of colour, into thinking that they are candidates that are just as good as anyone else, probably more so, because they provide, you know, a more unique perspective that we don't get to hear about in policymaking because they're just not in the room. So I think it's really important in that sense.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think as much as it's one thing for me and Amy to have these conversations about what it means for women, in the same way that you said yourself, Tom, maybe you can't come at it from a personal experience of what it's like to be a woman, we can't come at it from a personal experience of what it's like to be a woman of colour. And I think, again, the temptation is to go, that's really great, she's on a platform, how amazing for those people over there, I hope you do well, because it's not me, because I'm not a woman of colour. And there's so much more we can do around that. And I feel like we're making a lot of progress in this area, but again, we're not where we need to be. So it is on people, you know, like me and Amy and you guys, like on Owen and Tom, and on anyone who thinks it's important, you know, sensible people who think it's important, you know, black minority ethnic people have a voice in politics and in every kind of aspect of life, that we can be championing it. And it's one thing for us to say, oh, we need more women on the exec, and me and Amy are going to lead that charge to get, you know, more women on the exec, more women members. But we also have a responsibility to say, well, how many black and minority ethnic voices are we hearing? How many people are on the panel shows? How many people are we encouraging to join? Even though that might not be the group that we ascribe ourselves to, we should still be responsible for it. Because I think only when we do that, you know, as white women or white men, or, you know, kind of anyone who's not in maybe that specific group, only when we do that, similarly to what Amy said before, only when it's not a news story and only when everyone gets behind that, actually, yes, everyone should have a platform. I think if you believe we should have more women, then you should believe we have more people of colour, and we have more people who are LGBT, and more people who have, you know, disability, or more people that are older or younger. We should want full kind of inclusion and equality. And I know we do, obviously, on this exec team and on this call. But I think it's important for us to not just stop the conversation at what it means for women, but what it means for people of colour. And if you don't know the answer to that, or you don't know to help, there's so much resource out there. And I think a lot of the burden gets put on women to explain why we should have X, Y, and Z for women, the burden, I feel, gets put on people of colour to explain, why is this important? Can you tell me? Where actually, if you're a white person, you can find that information out yourself. You can, you know, you can read about it, you can watch documentaries, you can donate, you can educate yourself. And I think we all should bear that kind of responsibility to make sure we're educated and make sure it happens again, not kind of wait another 4 years if, you know, this election doesn't go the way that I think we all want it to go, oh, well, someone else will come along. We can actually all be really active in that journey to make sure that women's voices and voices from people of colour are heard and are amplified. Yeah, I just think that's an implication that actually we can all be involved in this progress, and I think we should be.
Okay, and now, Helen, Amy, we just thought we'd do some daft. We'll just ask a quick quiz. So, fingers on the mic. So the first question is: the writer and academic Beatrice Webb was a member of which left-wing membership organisation?
The Fabian Society.
Correct.
Second question: Harold Wilson was MP for which Northwest constituency, or constituencies, I should say?
This is rude, this quiz.
No, I honestly can't remember.
Was it somewhere in Yorkshire?
Northwest.
Oh, God. Right, okay, sorry. Jeez. No.
He was born in Yorkshire.
No. Did I get half a point for that?
Yeah, no, it's quite hard. In fairness, it's Heighton or Ormskirk. He represented Heighton while he was Prime Minister, but he was first elected as the MP for Ormskirk. There you go. You have to be from Merseyside, I guess, to know that.
Yeah.
And then here's an easy one. How many constituencies are there in the House of Commons?
650.
Sorry,
I was just ready with that one.
Right, second, we did an interview with her last week. Plug there for anyone who hasn't listened to the last podcast. Claire Hanna is SDLP MP for which Northern Irish constituency?
Oh, I knew this when I listened to it. I listened to it.
It's been a long time since last week.
Yeah. Not good.
Belfast South.
Hey! Right, the final question. Who was the first woman to become Labour Party leader, albeit acting leader?
Harriet Harman?
Incorrect.
Damn!
I was going to say Harriet Harman.
Blame me, I wrote...
Oh, Margaret Beckett!
Yay!
Is that...
Oh, well, maybe we should soften the questions next time. So
yeah, evidently. Oh, and you're right next time, because apparently I'm rubbish at writing.
All right.
There you go.
I mean, I didn't think they were that bad.
You know that whole thing around, like, oh, you don't have to know everything about politics to get involved in policy.
I'll do the quiz next time, Tom. Yeah.
Oh, right. I mean, that's the end of that.
If you want to get in touch with Amy, particularly to talk about women's issues, or, you know, get involved, get your CLP's women officer in contact with her, get in touch with Amy on her email at
amylouisedwyer@outlook.com.
Right, fantastic. And Helen?
It's helenclark460@gmail.com.
We have a new feature, which is Tom's Donald Trump fact check.
Fake news. It's fake. Phony. Fake.
And just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
They have no sources. They just make them up when there are none.
I didn't say that. No, I didn't.
Thank you so much for that, Owen. And today we're going to be looking at Trump's claim about the moving of the U.S. embassy out of Tel Aviv and into Jerusalem. Now, Donald Trump claimed at a rally the other day that he'd moved the capital of Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which just isn't true. He'd moved the embassy, but he also claimed that. Previously at the time, that he'd made the move in order to promote peace and cooperation in the Middle East and to try and end the conflict and hope. However, he claimed at this rally the other day that in fact he'd done it for the evangelicals, and that the evangelicals were in fact more in support of the move than American Jewish citizens, which, as it turns out, is true. Overwhelmingly, if you look at polling evidence, evangelicals often show sometimes greater support for Israel than Jewish Americans. This is largely because evangelicals present a lot of support for Israel because they believe that the fulfillment of a state of Israel whose capital is Jerusalem is the fulfillment of biblical scripture. Fascinatingly, though, for some sections of evangelicals in America, the reason they want it is actually because it doesn't just fulfill scripture. In fact, it helps fulfill scripture for the end times. They believe that when they have the capital being Jerusalem, they are closer to the end times. And these are a section of Christians who are overwhelmingly excited for the return of Jesus, and therefore they believe that we are now heading towards the end times, and they want Donald to do all he can to be God's chosen person. And there is a feeling amongst evangelicals that Donald Trump is perhaps God's work. He is doing God's work on earth. And that he is. So it's quite fascinating then that Donald Trump would claim at the time that he did it for peace and would now openly admit that really he did it to appease his evangelical base, which is a base that is continuing to be loyal to him and will be crucial if Donald is to have any hope of a re-election in November.
Fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
And just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
They have no sources. They just make them up when there are none.
I didn't say that. I didn't.
Thank you for listening, everyone. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. You can find our other episodes of the podcast and upcoming episodes on Spotify or whatever platform you are listening to this podcast on. So yeah, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.